Okay, so for the first of today's lectures, I want to talk about the Lie derivative and also just to rapidly recap the covariant derivative, because obviously I know you've already done that, but we'll just sort of briefly refresh what we know about that. So the Lie derivative is a derivative that can be applied to geometric objects, but it's quite restrictive. It's sort of a derivative with respect to a vector field. And it's probably the derivative that's closest to the standard sort of real calculus derivative that I wrote down yesterday when I was trying to sort of get us to think about how we could differentiate on a manifold and what could go wrong. So the picture of a Lie derivative is that we've got some vector field, U, and the vector field is, of course, tangent to some lines. And the idea is that if we have, so here we've got, say, this is point RP, and up here is P plus delta P. And so this is our U at each case. And then we've got a vector field, V. I'll just start with a vector field for simplicity. And this V is changing. So V depends on where you are in the manifold. So this is V at P plus delta P, and this is V at P. And so in our standard sort of notional formula for a derivative, we wanted to compare V here with V there. And of course, the problem was that they were in different tangent spaces. Now, the feature about the vector field U, or what enables you to do that, is that U provides a way of actually pushing forward this vector V from the point P to the point P plus delta P, so that they're now in the same tangent space, and you can then compare them. So that's the idea of the Lie derivative. So here, this curve gamma, which has tangent U. We think of gamma. Just going to. Sort of obvious what this is, but I'll just mention this definition. Gamma is an integral curve. We call these curves to which U is tangent integral curves. So that's our picture. And now I just want to talk briefly about this notion of pushing forward vector fields. Just write down what I just said. So really what the vector field is doing is actually sort of, at least locally, it's providing a map of the manifold to itself. It's saying that you take your manifold and you're going to slide it a little bit along these integral curves of U. So it's like a coordinate transformation. But it's, as usual, infinitely differentiable, one-to-one, onto, et cetera, et cetera. So I want to just review or write down a few things about maps between manifolds to make this just a little bit clearer. I'm going to be quite sketchy here. I'm just going to jot down the sort of essentials. So the general picture. is that we've got two manifolds, M and N, not necessarily the same dimensionality. And we're going to have a map F from M to N. And we might have a notion, of course, we've got some chart with some coordinates X mu in R to the M. And we've got another chart in N. With coordinates y, and so where you can see that my what I'm meaning here is that this or some open set here maps into some open set or some set there, and this induces a map between R to the M and R to the N. So it's really sort of whenever I talk about things being differentiable or smooth or well-defined, as always, I'm sort of thinking about where we can actually do our differentiation in the underlying charts. So in the case that we want here with the Lie derivative, if M is N, as in the two manifolds have the same dimensionality, and F is 1 to 1, and at least locally onto, and differentiable, et cetera, et cetera. Then this map is a diffeomorphism and M and N are regarded as the same. So typically you're used to this notion of maps between sets and this idea of one-to-one or a map being onto. And all this is saying is that this map between these two sets, of course, our manifold is not just a set. It has an additional structure. It's got charts, et cetera, et cetera. It's simply saying that these maps preserve that notion. So that's really what we mean. And so in general, if we have the, again, going back to the general picture, so we can use our map between two manifolds to actually relate the tangent spaces. So if we look at our vector, our tangent space, we get something which is called a push-forward map. Where Q, if I'm thinking of Q as sort of being F of P here, right? Mm-hmm.
Just making sure the map is between two different tangent spaces and two different cotangent spaces, right?
So in this case, what I'm doing is here I'm trying to relate a tangent space in M to a tangent space in N. And so, yeah, I mean that one's a tangent space on one manifold, the other's a tangent space on the other manifold. And so we're going to show how you can map one into the other. So if we've got our manifold M, how do we construct a vector? Well, we saw that we constructed a vector by having a curve and looking at the tangent to the curve. So we can take our manifold M, we map it into N. We've got a new curve, gamma primed, which is the image of gamma under the function F. And then if we have a tangent vector here, S, so this is our point P, this is our point Q, and here's a tangent vector T. So here our gamma primed is. Then if S is the tangent to gamma, then we have a very natural tangent to gamma primed, because this curve here is some sort of traces out a path in the manifold M with parameter T, and we map it to a curve over here, again tracing out a path with the same parameter T. So we have an identification of a vector in N with a vector in M. And so this exists in general, but obviously if the dimensionality of the manifolds are different, then you can't necessarily, you can't go from tangent of N back over. Then there's the pullback map. On the cotangent spaces, which goes in the other direction. Yes.
Why can't you go in the other direction in the tangent spaces?
So because if, so basically if the dimensionality is different, you know, you can't necessarily invert it. So, I mean, you've got to kind of ask, what can I, you know, what can I actually uniquely identify? So in this case, we know we can take a curve in M, and it's absolutely unambiguous that maps to a curve in N. But there may be curves in N which don't have some pre-image over in M, for example. So, but we know we can do this. So this is fine. But we can't necessarily go back. However, of course, if we're in the situation where we've got the same manifold, same dimension, you know, all nice, smooth, infinitely differentiable, et cetera, we can go both ways. So once we know how to push our vectors forward, we can then pull back our covectors, because remember, a covector is a map from the vector space down into the reals. And so we can take a map. So we're saying that we've got a map from T down to the reals here, which, so this is some nu of T, say. And so all we simply look at which vector did this actually, or, you know, if we've got this map down into the reals, we can then kind of construct a map coming from M into the reals. So, just what I was saying earlier, if you have one of these diffeomorphisms, your map is invertible, so you can kind of go either way. So what I now want to do is to write down what this map is corresponding to the vector field. So what we're going to be thinking about is just very small shifts in the manifold. So we're simply taking a small coordinate transformation by moving our manifold a little bit along these integral curves of U. So here's our picture. Here's just a set of integral curves of U, and here is, say, T naught, and then we're just going to move a little bit, T naught plus delta T. So that's kind of our shift. And so I really get through the chalk. Is there any? Right, so this diffeomorphism, which is just a re-identification or a relabeling of our manifold, that's really what a coordinate transformation is, because remember, our coordinate transformations are just simply looking at intersections of charts and saying that the map between the coordinates is infinitely differentiable. And all that is just a different way of labeling the space-time coordinates. And so here, we can relabel our space-time coordinates by sort of shifting t equals zero just a little way along u. So that's sort of what we're doing here. And you can see that I'm just doing this to linear order, because what I want to do is to think about a derivative. And so delta t is what's going to zero. So these are the pieces that I actually need. And so this is defining ourselves a new chart. So what's this push forward in this particular case of our vector V? Well, V star, we know how to do a coordinate transformation. When we do a coordinate transformation on a vector, thanks, Tibra, we simply take the standard matrix of the coordinate, you know, the new coordinates with respect to the old coordinates. But here are our new coordinates. So they're almost the same as the old coordinates. So our V is almost unchanged. But we do have a delta T piece. My little subscript naught indicates things are evaluated here at T naught, which I'm just calling naught. So our V pushing forward is V back at naught plus a little piece which tells us how this U changes. Okay? So now we can compare our two Vs. So the definition of our Lie derivative, so we write it as a curly L for Lie. So that is, that's our expression. It's exactly like the calculus definition. We take V at, I should say, V at delta T plus delta T, and we compare that, we subtract off V at T naught pushed forward to T plus delta T and divide by delta T. So VT, well, this is our vector field. If we look right back at that very first sketch, this is our vector field at P plus delta P. So once again, we're just going to Taylor expand. So this is V of XT. And so Taylor expanding, that's V mu of X naught. Plus the partial derivative of V along U. So that's what our vector field is at P plus delta P. And of course, you can see I'm working now in the chart. I'm working in my abstract index notation. Well, actually, it doesn't matter here, but I'm kind of working now in a particular coordinate system. And so if I put that in here, and say, well, what are the components of the Lie derivative of V with respect to U? Well, here we've got V at X naught, and here we've got V of X naught, so they cancel. That's good news. And then we're left with delta T terms, so our delta T's cancel. So again, everything's working so far. And so we're simply left with this derivative of V along U, and the derivative of U along V. So that is the Lie derivative of a vector. And notice, at least for the vector, this kind of anti-symmetry. We've got an expression involving U and V, and then we swap U and V and put a minus sign. So we can go through this process here, again, applying the same general definition for any tensorial object. We take the tensorial object at T plus delta T, we take it at T, and push forward the vectorial bits and pull back the covector pieces so that we get our expression now pushed of the vector at the sort of T naught, but you know, dragged along to T plus delta T, and you see that all the sort of background pieces cancel and you end up with a nice expression. So I'll just tell you what the covector piece is, and you build it up rather like the covariant derivative. You do something for each index. So for a covector, once again, you take the derivative of the covector along U, but this time you add. Now, it's not really, you can't take the derivative of U along omega because omega is not a vector, but instead you take the free derivative, partial derivative of U, but now contract the vector index of U with your one form. So that's So essentially you're taking the partial derivative of your geometric object along U, and then for each vector index, you take the derivative of U with respect to that vector index, and for each covector index, you take the free derivative of U contracted with the covector index. So that's how you build it up. So there's another way of writing the Lie derivative. Because notice that the Lie derivative of a vector is also a vector. So that means that the Lie derivative is a map that takes two vectors and gives you a vector back. It's not a product, but it's the best we can do. So the other way we can write it is which is perhaps more familiar. We can also write for vectors the Lie derivative as a bracket, the Lie bracket. And we can define it without all this faff over here, thinking about maps and manifolds. We simply define it as a commutator. So remember, a vector at a particular tangent space maps a function down into the reals. So vector field is going to be mapping C infinity of M into C infinity of M in general, sort of over the whole manifold. And so we simply take U of V of F and then reverse the order. And that gives us the same answer. But the nice thing about the Lie derivative is it generalizes to arbitrary tensors. So what does it mean, this Lie derivative? So I just want to briefly sort of prove a little result about the geometrical significance. So what we can do suppose we've got two vector fields, Ru and Rv. We could imagine going a little way along an integral curve of V to this point A, and then a little way along an integral curve of U to the point B. Or we could go a little way along U to the point C, and a little way along V to the point D. There is absolutely no reason for a general vector field that this process should be commutative. So it just depends. And so what I'm just going to demonstrate for you is that this direction, B to D, is proportional to the Lie derivative of UV. So in order to do that, just write down. So you could think of it, it's how much the square doesn't close, or alternatively, one feature that is, you know, that is true about coordinate systems is that coordinate systems uniquely label the points of the manifold. And so we can think of coordinate lines as being integral curves of vector fields. And so in that case, if we have a coordinate system, then the coordinate basis is going to have, zero Lie bracket, because whether you go along X and then Y, or along Y then X, you always get to the same point. You have to, otherwise it would be meaningless. So here, this is sort of saying, how bad is this pair of vector fields as a coordinate system? So just a couple of things that we're going to need. I'm going to write again this coordinate transformation, but I'm going to need to go to second order because obviously the discrepancy here between B and D is actually, you know, you can, well, as always, my art is somewhat dubious, but this really is should be smaller than either of these distances here. So we'll call the parameter along V S and the parameter along U T. So this point here, A, is going a distance S along V, and I just want to write that to order S squared. So these are the sort of pieces of it, these are the pieces of information that I'm going to need. Right, so I'll first write down what the point B is, and then we'll see that we can write down what the point D is simply by swapping U's and V's and S's and T's. So my point B is going to be, looking at this, my point A plus T U at A plus a half T squared, and then that's going to be U nu, U mu comma nu. So that's simply applying this relation, but in going from A to B. And now I'd go back. I want to now put these subscripts A back to zero. So XA is X0 plus SV plus a half S squared V dV. Then my second piece, well, UA was U naught. And then this final piece is already order T squared, so it's already, sorry, that's U, not V. So that's simply expanding out. It's nothing difficult going on here. It's just a bit of an algebraic slog. And then to get my XD, I simply swap U and V and S and T. So these are the coordinates of B and D in some local chart. So I just simply want to note that this term is the same. Here we've got an SV naught. Here we've got an SV naught. Here we've got a half S squared V dV. And here I've got a half S squared V dV. Here we've got a half T squared U dU. And here we've got a half T squared U du. And there, here we've got two T U's. So if I actually look at what the difference is, then, as promised, the difference is proportional to the Lie bracket. So, again, I'll emphasize this is a calculation which I'm doing in some local chart. I shouldn't really be able to take a position vector BD because I'm on a curved manifold, but we're in a neighborhood of zero where I'm making S and T as small as I like, infinitesimally small, which allows me to go down into the underlying Rn, the underlying sort of copy of R to the n corresponding to some local chart or inertial frame on the manifold. So within Rn, I can take a position vector. So obviously, this is only correct up to some power, in this case, order S or T cubed, but it is, at least up to the order I've written it, is a correct statement. So why do we find the Lie derivative useful? Well, part of it is that we're going to kind of use it when we come to redoing or rederiving curvature and talking about Cartan's equations. But the other thing where it comes in useful is thinking about symmetries of the metric. So once again, I'm just going to hop forward slightly, you know, making use of the fact that you're familiar with the space-time metric. So the Lie derivative is going to tell us about symmetries. It's a sort of very specific type of derivative and is the closest, in some sense, to our standard real derivative. And so if we have a vector or a vector field, U, which has, if you take the Lie derivative of the metric, gives you zero, so it has a vanishing Lie derivative of the metric, then that actually indicates that U tells you about a symmetry of the metric. So we call this U a killing vector. So typically, we denote a killing vector by K rather than U, just to emphasize that it's one of these special vector fields. So we use these killing vectors often to simplify a metric. So if we know that we have, for example, SO3 symmetry, then what that means is that there is a group of symmetries on the manifold which has a structure of SO3, and what that translates into is a set of killing vectors with SO3 algebra. So in that case, we've got three killing vectors, which form an SO3 algebra. And then once we've sort of got those killing vectors, we can then translate that back into particular properties of, if we choose the right coordinates, we choose coordinates that correspond to our killing vectors, then we can translate that into simplifications of our metric. So let me just do a very, very simple example. So we're going to take our two-sphere. This is our sort of prototype manifold. And here is our metric, our standard metric on the two-sphere, a unit two-sphere, obviously. And then we're going to say K, I'm going to demonstrate to you, is that this is a killing vector. So d by d phi is a very, very common killing vector that crops up in GR. So to see why it is a killing vector, well, LK of G, let's look at the mu nu components. So remember, we take the Lie derivative of a covariant object. What we do first is we take the derivative along the vector field K. And then for each of the covariant indices, we take a derivative of K. Now, because K is just d by d phi, K phi is 1. And so that's a constant. And so those terms vanish. And so this is simply d by d phi of G mu nu, and you can see that there's absolutely no phi dependence of the components of the metric. There's only one non-trivial component, which is g phi phi, and that depends on theta. So that is zero. So that's sort of a very simple example of a Killing vector. Now, there's a relation that we're going to use later on, so I just want to state it now. Which relates the exterior derivative to the lead derivative. Or the bracket in this case. So here we're simply saying if we take the exterior derivative of a one form and then two arbitrary vectors u and v, and so we're mapping, we're sort of taking the contraction of u and v with d omega, then that's the same as u, a vector map of the function defined by omega contracted with v minus v swapped with u. And then, of course, we've got this Lie bracket piece of u and v. So that's sort of, you may want to just star that because I'm going to use it in the next lecture. Right, so just to take us to the end of this lecture, I'm going to just briefly cover the covariant derivative, yes? Or is that a stretch?
No, what do you mean by the comma in the left-hand side of the relation?
Oh, it's just to put an order between u and v. You don't have to comma it if you don't want to. I guess I just comma them. It's simply saying that on the left of the bracket is a two form. So there. So you need to, you know, given that I'm taking, it's a scalar equation. And so my two form is acting on u and v. So the ordering of u and v is important because it's a two-form, it's anti-symmetric. So whatever is on the right-hand side has to be anti-symmetric in u and v. So you can see that the first two terms clearly are because I just swapped u and v. But the first two terms don't quite work and you have to add the commutator as well. So yeah, that's... So I mean, I guess the comma is slightly superfluous. It's just emphasizing that these are just, you know, an ordered vector pair. Right, so the covariant derivative is the third of our examples, or the third type of derivative that we're going to do. And of course, it's the one that's absolutely central to general relativity, and it'll be the derivative that you've already met. And so the covariant derivative is a way of generalizing Nabla or grad, the grad of vector calculus, to a manifold. So the covariant derivative is completely general. It'll work on absolutely any geometric object, and it doesn't require any underlying geometric object, such as the vector field in the case of the Lie derivative. The price you pay is that in order to make it work, you have to add structure to your manifold. So the Lie derivative worked, whether or not you really had a metric, whether or not you actually knew how to link together tangent spaces in general. The covariant derivative works on anything, but it's telling you that there is a specific way of linking your tangent spaces together. So that's constraining this tangent bundle, if you like. And so what it's really doing is it's describing how the basis, or a particular basis, so we have a sort of particular basis of a tangent space, and it's telling us how these bases link together. So it's defined, we write it as grad, which is a derivation. So it defines, or it usually we write it in terms of, so grad is our derivation. We act on a basis vector. I said the connection describes how the bases at different points link together. And this is usually how we encode it in these gammas. So these gammas here are scalars, and they are the connection coefficients. So that's normally how we actually describe it. Or we could write omega so that's how we normally write it, but the definition is that grad is a derivation. Which commutes with contractions. In other words, if we've got something with a covector and a vector, then if you act on it by grad, you either act on the scalar or you can sort of do a Leibniz. It can go inside as well. It doesn't care. Like any derivative, we expect a Leibniz property. And finally, rather like sort of everything always seems to reduce to D on functions. Mm-hmm.
So you said there's scalars and connection coefficients are scalars.
Yes.
So if I go to the next expression, I do a quotient transformation. I guess that's a basis label. So.
No, it's just with respect. So the connection components are always defined with respect to a particular basis. So they are always sets of scalars. And of course, as you've already seen, when they were first introduced, presumably you saw that in fact they don't transform in a tensorial fashion under a coordinate transformation, as indeed they better not have, because what they do is they cancel off that second derivative of coordinates that makes the partial derivative such a bad idea when we want to do to take the derivative of a vector. So this is where now this sort of difference, so remember I made some comments yesterday about the abstract index notation. We're going to see now what I was, or hopefully it'll be a bit clearer what I was trying to drive at. So if we look at a vector, then grad of V, So this is now a geometric object, grad of V. Well, this is going to be grad of my vector is expressible in terms of components with respect to some basis EA. So now I use property one, which is that grad, well, properties one and two, which is that grad is Leibnizian and doesn't particularly care, you know, about summing over indices and things. So we've got grad EA times VA plus EA grad VA. So our grad EA, well, that was what I wrote down initially as the definition of the connection components. So grad of EA is gamma, did with B, didn't I? CBA. So that's my first piece. And then the second piece. So this is where it is clear we are not using abstract index notation. For the second piece, I am using property three, which is that grad reduces to D when acting on scalars. So I have EAD of VA here. So now I'm just going to reshuffle some of my index labels here. I've got a minute, I want to make sure I've got the right. I want that to be A and I want that to be C. Right. So I've just relabeled my indices to make sure that the labels on my E and the labels on my omega are the same in each case. So grad V is now the usual expression so that's when I say usual expression that would be what you would write down in this abstract index notation but notice that in order to get to that I very definitely did not use abstract index notation because at this point I have said that the VAs are scalars. So that's there, I'm being very specific that these are the components of V in a coordinate basis.
From the first line, I see we see that VA in the EA basis, mm-hmm. right?
I mean, it's sort of clear from, usually it's clear when you're going through, but I'm emphasizing here the difference between what we usually do when we do, we would normally write down grad V was this, yeah. right? And that is an abstract index way of doing it because we're saying that, you know, grad B VA equals this thing, right? But the reason that's okay is because if you actually go through it carefully, treating the V's as components, but adding in the basis gives you the connection coefficients. Yeah?
So the covariant derivative takes a vector to 1, 1 tensor.
Yes. So grad carries a covector nature. It's covectorial in nature. But it doesn't really have an existence of its own, in the sense that the way it looks depends on what it is acting upon, because if it acts on a single vector, as you get one gamma term. If it acts on a tensor, rank two contravariant tensor, you get two gammas. If it acts on a covariant, you get a gamma, but with a minus sign. So it's not a tensor in and of itself. It has to act on something. So in GR, as of course you know, we use the metric connection. So that's defined by grad G equals zero. But that's not the end of the story. We also have to actually impose an additional condition on our connection, which is that something called the torsion has to vanish. So what is torsion? Well, you define it, TUV, it's again, it's like a commutator of covariant derivatives of two vectors. So that is the torsion tensor, and it's a map from TP of M cross TP of M into TP of M. And it's almost the same. So T equals zero for the metric connection, and it's almost saying that gamma is symmetric.
So what is Nabla U?
So Nabla U, I'll just write it down. It's sort of the kind of the obvious thing, but it's basically saying that, as we were just we're discussing a couple of minutes back, that the Nabla comes with a covariant index. And even though it's not really a tensor, it comes along with a covariant index. And so you're simply saying that you mop that up with the vector U. So it's the covariant derivative all along the vector field U. Sorry, I can't hear it.
So we can use this as a definition of the free derivative. I mean, the first part of the right-hand side of that equation, we have the torsion free condition.
Yes, because if we knew we had a torsion-free connection, then we could say the Lie derivative is the commutator of the covariant derivatives. And in fact, it is true, we often write down the Lie bracket. It's just one of those things that we can either write a partial or a covariant derivative for the Lie bracket, but that is actually coming along with the assumption that there is no torsion. And, torsion, if you had it, would be an additional physical field on the space-time, because it's an extra piece of information. It's a tensor. It's a geometric object. And it's something that's independent of the metric, because it's an additional assumption that we have to put in on the connection that we use in GR. And so it really is something extra that we have. So let me just quickly finish off by writing down what the components are. So as I said, it's almost the same as saying you've got a symmetric connection, but if you're in the coordinate basis, of course, the Lie bracket vanishes, so these structure constants are zero, and in a coordinate basis, vanishing torsion is exactly the same as saying your connection is symmetric. But in general, in a general basis, you may have non-vanishing Lie brackets of your basis vectors, in which case you have these things called structure constants. It's just telling you how much your basis or how far away it is from being one of these coordinate bases. And so, of course, in a coordinate basis, we get the feet that... If we look and we demand that grad G vanishes, that we have no torsion, which means in a coordinate basis our connection is symmetric, then we get the usual expression, which of course, you will have already seen. So that's just a lightning review of the covariant derivative. And then next lecture, we're going to look at ways of computing connections and curvature using something called the Cartan formalism. So again, it's going to be very much like that sort of top board there. We're going to be using this geometric notation. We're going to be using forms and exterior differentiation.